Real information, good conversation, unabashedly Wisconsin. You're listening to Up North News.
Now, for once, this is not me. If we're playing Yacht Rock, it's quite often it's Luke Mathers, our producer, trying to get under my skin as we start the second hour of Up North News for this Monday, September 12th. But it's actually because our guest later in the hour, Annalise Eicher, is, again, somebody who is way too young to appreciate Yacht Rock, and yet she does. So we will bond over our love of Yacht Rock as well as politics and news headlines coming up. One of the more interesting things I noted over the weekend in terms of activity around Wisconsin was a Twitter thread, and I have to admit, I'm not familiar with Lauren Windsor, a self-described advocacy journalist. But I think as I read through what she was going through Friday night in Appleton, you'll still, like me, you'll appreciate it nonetheless. It appears that she was there to record Republican speakers at a dinner there, because her thread begins, "I've been caught in the act of an election denier dinner in Appleton, Wisconsin. One of the staffers here recognized me and I could see them huddling. They didn't approach, so I tried not to be paranoid. But they just had the MC, regular Joe." I think that's a radio host in Green Bay. I could be wrong. "But they just had the MC name check me during his opening speech. I'm still here recording their speeches, and they invited me up on stage. I'm here minding my P's and Q's, listening to Michael Gableman, the guy who got fired by Robin Voss for spending over $1 million in Wisconsin's BS election audit. And Gableman addressed me too. He's saying that Mark Zuckerberg stole the election for Biden and railing against drop boxes, crying fraud, says that no one has challenged his actual report." Lauren Windsor continues, "I just raised my hand to ask Gableman a question, and they invited me on stage. Why he didn't produce documents from his investigation to the Wisconsin judge who held him in contempt of court. Gableman..."
Sorry, ladies and gentlemen, I'm just having a little couple technical difficulties here with Pat. We're talking Gableman and the dinner that was tended to.
Search to find the love within. I
You've tried everything. From Lake Wissota, once again, here's Pat Kreitlow.
Yeah, we mentioned it was going to be a Yacht Rock Hour with Annalise Eicher joining us. First off, we want to say we are still trying to figure out what our technical difficulty was in our last segment, so I'm not sure yet if you heard the story I was telling or if you just heard a bunch of Yacht Rock while Luke was looking into it. So that's the joy of doing this, live radio via Zoom from a place 200 miles away from the other studio. But I'm delighted to be reconnected now and be connected with my friend Annalise Eicher. How are you?
Morning, Pat. Thanks for having me on. And I'm good. It's shorts and hoodie weather. So we're easing into fall here. Yeah, I love the Yacht Rock, so appreciate the welcome.
Oh yeah, I mean, look, Luke Mathers is an old friend of yours. Let me know right away that what I already knew, that we bond over our love of Yacht Rock, despite the fact that you are decades too young to recognize what it is, much less be a fan of it.
Hey, I have boomer parents.
There you go. Well, if that were the thing alone, I'd be playing nothing but Neil Diamond. Because my mom was like a Neil Diamond super fan back in the day. And so I'm pretty sure I went through my teens and 20s loathing Neil Diamond. And then as often happens when you get older and, you know, you kind of go, oh, my parents weren't that crazy. And now I can appreciate Neil Diamond. But boy, for the longest time, nails on a chalkboard, you know. Now it's not. Bumped into Annalise at the Brewers game on Saturday, because you get to about how many games in a normal season?
Oh, goodness. We try to get to as many as we can. If they're home on a weekend, we try to get to a game.
Yeah. I get to, you know, if I'm lucky, one, and I was lucky and had some great seats, and it was great to talk to you at that point, mostly because the Brewers were winning. It hadn't started, you know, the flooding rains hadn't started yet.
I honestly, Pat, thought the fact that the roof was open the entire time, I thought for sure we were going to see a closed roof over at AmFam Field, but it was open the whole time. It was a great game, and we had the bonus of running into you.
And I'm glad the rains didn't come, because we stood outside the stadium after the game for a very long time before my friend and I finally appreciated the fact that we missed our shuttle bus.
Oh, no.
It wasn't coming back. Yeah. That I thought it had the name of the bar on the side, but it must have been one of those with a more generic bus company name or something. And
sure,
we watched it go right past and you know, didn't flag it down or whatnot. So we eventually found a very nice Uber or taxi driver. We somehow got through the language barrier and got back to the bar in the car and in one piece. And I sound like I'm now trying to dissuade people from going to a ball game, and I am not. Just don't miss your shuttle bus. Don't do what we did.
That is key. And they do tell you in advance, Pat, when those shuttles are coming and going and when the last shuttle is. So maybe the lesson here is that we just pay attention.
Oh yeah. Paying attention, I've learned, is a really good thing. And I'm usually better about that, but apparently my enthusiasm to get to the Brewers game got the better of me. Annalise and I worked at One Wisconsin Now. Well, she worked there. I was on the board of directors. And again, this was about 2.5 million years ago, but I really wanted to have her on the show at some point, especially when it became apparent that President Joe Biden was going to forgive a chunk of student loan debt. Because we knew years ago that doing so could be a real jolt to local economies as well as households, and that that is a much different frame than, oh, they said they would pay for it. You know, they took out a loan knowing the terms and that they would pay it back. And this is something unfair, when instead there's so much more to it. And what this move is doing is going to cause so much more benefit. But before we get to all that, take me back to, I believe it was 2009, when One Wisconsin Now, the very mighty progressive little think tank that could, first started saying, you know what, I think there's an issue here. How did that come up?
Sure. So, you know, I was not yet at One Wisconsin when they started this work. I was actually working at United Council of UW Students. So I was working on tuition issues and issues affecting the students within the UW system. And there was a great overlap because the folks over at OWN had started to talk about, you know, the student debt issue. And the reason and how that came about, I think, was just a group of people who were consistently paying hundreds of dollars every single month for years, started realizing the impact and not just the impact on their personal lives, but the impact on our overall economy and overall ability as people to, you know, to make those purchases, and not to make this sound like, you know, spending, but, you know, purchases or savings or those things that our parents' generation were able to do with no problem. Mm-hmm. And so it started with those internal conversations. And I think the next step was like, okay, there's gotta be more than it. Like, if this is impacting this small group of folks right here in this big of a way, there has to be a larger question. And so, you know, we just started talking about it, and we put together a scientific survey and thought, okay, maybe we're going to get, a couple hundred people maybe to respond. You know, if we get 200, we can do something with that. And hundreds and, you know, I think thousands of folks replied. And I think it was at that point we realized just the sheer impact that student debt was having on folks' lives. And not just like, you know, hey, it helped me get my degree and this is great, but hey, this debt is actually impacting my ability to replace my car, or this debt is impacting my ability to buy a home, have children, save for retirement, start a business. So those life things that we, you know, we're supposed to be able to do, we're not in existence and in a mass scale. And so that's really where it started. And, you know, a lot of folks didn't want to talk about it at first. Talking about your debt in America and talking about your debt in Wisconsin, like, that is not something that we do. And we also...
But I think it opened up people's eyes to this note. And you hinted at this. It used to be that this really is a condemnation of how legislatures allowed education debt to explode, that you used to be able to pay for tuition, room and board and everything else, basically with what you earned during a summer job. And yeah. I think that when this topic first started really taking hold of the public's attention, I think maybe they were still thinking that that was the case and hadn't really caught up to the huge discrepancy between, you know, education costs versus affordability.
Yeah, and that's real. I mean, I personally worked three jobs the summer after my freshman year of college. And I had scholarships and loans and, you know, still could not, you know, afford the tuition without getting some help. And I think, you know, folks, because we weren't talking about it, you know, we thought we were the outliers, right?
Right.
We thought,
right.
Okay, well, this other people aren't experiencing this. And that's really not the case at all. I mean, there are, you know, the number of borrowers in Wisconsin and in the country is just, it's insane. We just have never talked about it. And so, you know, being able to start that conversation and to show people and to tell people that they're not alone, you know, really helped spur this movement. And we were not the only organization working on this. We had some incredible partners across the country, including folks at Generation Progress and the Student Debt Crisis Organization that's, you know, based out in California. We had some folks that, you know, involved out in New York. It was just this, and, you know, our folks in the unions. I mean, the UAW was supportive of our work, you know, on this right away. And it's like, you know, not that their workers were, you know, necessarily impacted, but, you know, what's the one thing that you don't buy new if you don't have to? It's your car. Right. And so real, like real big purchasing issues, helped us build this incredible coalition. And it was all because people started talking about it.
And they also learned more about the predatory nature of some of this student lending.
Yeah.
And the differences, again, one of those surprising things is how student loan debt is treated in a bankruptcy versus others. It just stunned me when I first learned this.
Yeah. Well, and the fact that, you know, you can't refinance your student loans. So whatever interest rate you got when you were, you know, however old in college, that was the interest rate that you were stuck with. So some of us, you know, we're looking at 6.8%. Some of us got lucky at 3.4. You know what, those interest rates were, you were locked in, and you had no ability, if interest rates, you know, got better, you could refinance your car, refinance your house, refinance anything. You know, it's just the way that we treat this debt is so incredibly different. And discriminatory. And so the fact that we are at the point now, you know, all these years later, almost over a decade later, where we have a president who is canceling $10,000 or up to $20,000 of folks' debt. I mean, this is incredible. And this is going to be have such a positive impact for our economy, but also for people's lives. This is life changing.
Yeah. I mean, and to, like I said, to hear that, you know, student loan debt could not be discharged during a bankruptcy just felt so amazingly unfair. So we've gone back and talked about the growth in costs and the changing nature of student loan debt. Then, you know, talking about having some of that forgiven, the immediate impact, that is money that is no longer being sent monthly out of Wisconsin to banks and to the government or to other entities, that is money staying right here. People that put out, you know, they're not, instead of renting apartments, they can finally afford that down payment on a house. Instead of getting more miles out of the car, they're finally buying a new car, new appliances, whatever the.
They're saving for retirement. They're starting families. They, like, all of these dreams are now able to be realized because we're no longer sending money out of Wisconsin.
Yeah. And, or even just setting up a savings account for their own children,
yes,
for their
education, themselves.
Now that they know how expensive it's going to be.
Yes.
It's
or a savings account for themselves.
Yes. Yeah. Because we know that Americans have not been good about saving. And this was definitely one big part of the reason for it. And unfortunately, the whole matter of whether and then how much of this debt to forgive started to get away from us, because like other things in the Biden administration, the inner debate took hold of the news cycle, and it was more about, you know, Democrats in disarray than it was about the fact that this is even being considered in the first place. So we'll talk a bit more about that on the other side of the break. I got to ask Annalise for later in the hour. Got a favorite Yacht Rock group or song you want to make sure that Luke puts down for us?
Oh, some Bobby Caldwell for sure.
Oh, but we just started the hour with that. But we
could just play it. We could just play it. Just constant Bobby Caldwell.
That should be our new theme.
I also accept Michael McDonald.
Always, always. All right, always. Back with more Yacht Rock and Annalise Eicher next. You're up north.
Follow Up North News with our daily newsletter. Go to our website, upnorthnewswi.com, and click newsletter on the top banner. Once again, here's Pat Kreitlow.
Coming up in our next hour, we're going to examine the electric grid issues in Texas and California and see what that tells us about our needs in Wisconsin, and tear down some of the snark about some life or death energy issues coming from politicians that sure seem attached to big oil. That's in our next hour. Annalise Eicher is with us in this hour. We've been talking about student loan debt, and before I pivot away from that, it'll be a natural pivot because we'll be talking about Democrats. Can't talk about Democrats without using the word disarray. And yet the buzz phrase this year has been Democrats in array, because it appears that finally they can stop talking something to death in public and get something done. And so, I mean, I can certainly tell you about my frustrations watching them talk about weather and then how much, you know, progress to make on student loan debt and the fire they were taking from the left before they were taking it from the right. But what was your own impression watching this debate unfold over the past few months?
So, you know, I think, you know, similar, you know, to you, looking at, you know, what was coming from the left, look at what was coming from the right, you know, all of the infighting and those external discussions from, you know, folks on the outside. You know, we, regardless of the issue, you are always going to have folks who say this is absolutely a bad idea. And then you're going to have folks that say this is absolutely not far enough. And I think the thing that we need to remember is that we have a president who did something. This is, you know, trillions of dollars impacting millions of people across this country. And we are going to see some relief. Is it perfect? Absolutely not. Nothing is. Nothing is, but this is something, and we have a president who is doing something, and we have folks, you know, in Congress who are supporting the doing of that something, and that something just happens to be student debt relief that is going to change people's lives.
And taking that kind of action again takes time if you're not simply carrying out somebody else's orders from on high, in which, you know, everybody snaps a salute and says, yes, sir, yes, ma'am, and do what they're told. That has never been what the Democratic Party has been about, as Will Rogers told us almost a century ago. But in time, ideas are considered, investments are made. And that takes me to where I want to pivot next, and that is Democrats and progressives organizing across Wisconsin. Now, it wasn't that long ago that the people in the state, people who were active in the state party, were having a particularly fierce debate that, to me, kind of centered on, do we just try to keep squeezing a few more votes out of Madison, Milwaukee, and other, you know, strongly Democratic areas, because it's just too hard to find the needles in the haystacks across rural Wisconsin? Or do you do the work of, you know, making those investments and finding people in all 72 counties? You spend a lot of time up in the Eagle River area. And are you seeing evidence of that investment, of that focus on getting a few more votes? Because, by the way, if you win a statewide race by one vote, you know, that one voter in Eagle River counts as much as that one voter in Madison.
Yes, they do. And, you know, yeah, I'm very lucky to spend some time in the Northwoods, and it's gorgeous country up there. You know, it's re-energizing. And, you know, what I've really noticed, you know, under the Evers administration, under the Biden administration, is that, you know, the Democrats are the ones who invest, not just in our cities, but who invest in our suburbs and who invest in our rural communities. And, you know, we're seeing those infrastructure investments. You know, every single time I drive by a traffic cone when I'm headed up on 39 and 51, you know, that is an investment. Those road improvements are because of the Democrats. You know, when I'm watching the local news up there, because I love the local news, you know, and we've got stories about the, you know, impact of funding that is coming into local nonprofits and organizations so that they're able to better serve the communities. That the Democrats did that. And, you know, being able to see that in real time, and to see the impact that those have on, you know, on those communities, you know, the same way I see it here in Dane County, is awesome. And I think it's important that we, you know, we do fight and we do the work in every corner, in every city, in every town, every unincorporated village, you name it, we have to do the work, because there is, you know, more that unites us than divides us. And, you know, our local politics and local, who is in those positions, whether that's your mayor or your city council, your village board, all of those folks, those people matter just as much as the people we elect, you know, to the state assembly, to the governor, to the president, because they're also making decisions, you know, for us. And so, yeah, we have to do the work, and we have to keep identifying, and we have to keep telling the stories, the good stories, the bad stories. We have to keep, you know, that going, because when we do, we get those investments like infrastructure spending. We get investments in our roads. We get investments in cleaning up our wells and our, you know, lead pipe issues. We get investments in our farms, in our, you know, in our communities, to our nonprofits, all of that. And that stuff matters on a day-to-day basis for so many folks. And I didn't even mention schools. I mean, goodness, the amount of investment that, you know, we're able to make in our schools, not doesn't just matter here in Dane County or in Milwaukee, it matters up north too. It matters in southeast Wisconsin.
And you're one of those poster children for local involvement. You know, a lot of people can't name who's on their city council or county board. You're one of those who can.
I can. And I will say, to folks listening, like, if you don't know the name of your city council person, if you don't know the name of your county board supervisor, find out, and find out where they stand on things. You know, we have across Wisconsin, we have 72 counties. We have thousands of municipalities, and each of those has its own level of government. And the folks in those positions, you know, myself included, I serve on the Dane County Board of Supervisors. We make decisions every day that impact, you know, our community. And, you know, I'll say when we first moved to Sun Prairie, we are a community that consistently votes for Democrats. And yet when we moved to Sun Prairie, our school board, our city council, our county board were all represented by conservatives. And it's because folks did not engage in local elections. And so we started organizing and we started identifying, like, hey, you care about these issues. You ever thought about running for local office? We'll get you some resources. We'll help you out. And we've been able to do that. And there's folks that do that all over the state. And really that's how we're going to continue to make an impact positive change in our communities, is by, you know, really focusing on the local level, making sure we've got people who are in there who are making decisions about, you know, whether or not we're banning books in schools, or, you know, we're, you know, have state laws that impact our, you know, community safety, or, you know, that we're investing in community services versus, you know, just the same old stuff. And change is hard and it takes a lot of work, but it's so worth it. It's so worth it.
You know, from an upper level view of this, I would use the phrase building the bench, and that there are different ways to build a bench of your future leaders. Mm-hmm. What happened though, the first go around, you know, 15 years ago in trying to build a bench, and it may have been a little, may not have been as intentional or deliberative as the current wave. But a lot of us who ran in 2006 and won because there was so much frustration with the Iraq War and with the George W. Bush administration, won legislative seats in 2006. And then some more legislative seats were run in 2008. And there was all this talk about building this new bench that was, going to have progressive leaders as baby boomer leaders continued to retire. And then 2010 happened. And, the next couple of cycles after that simply decimated the progressive bench. But in part, that's because it did start at the state legislative level. And I think sometime after that, after Act 10 and everything else that we saw, going on at the local level, there became that effort to say, wait a minute, what about this county board? Why are there, so many conservatives on here when there are so many progressive pockets across the area? So between that and school boards now, especially the way that they're being targeted by the right wing, I think you do see that bench building from the true grassroots levels of government, the way that it really should be done, and then start to win those legislative seats in what are very tough gerrymandered districts, but at least start with people who have local elective experience.
Yeah, and I'll say this, building the bench, yes, absolutely important. But I don't want to minimize the importance of electing folks who are totally okay with just doing incredible work on their county board and doing incredible work on their city council or village board. And it's, we always have to be, of course, thinking about what's next. And, if you're going to step up to run for that next level, who else can serve? And that's work. It involves, hard conversations and grassroots organizing. And, what's wonderful is that in Wisconsin, we have a lot of support for that kind of work. We have organizations, we have people who are willing to say, yeah, I'm going to help you get elected. And, I'm one of those people. so it's important. And it matters that we have, because, speaking, you used to mention gerrymandering, we are incredibly lucky to have Tony Evers as our governor and his veto pen. But we know that we have a legislature that's been gerrymandered to the point that, if we did not have Governor Evers, the decisions that they would be making would be absolutely detrimental to our state and would have incredibly horrific, and I'm not saying that lightly, impacts on our local governments. As a local legislator, I thank Governor Evers every single day for that veto pen, because the decisions that the Republicans would like to make that would have just an absolutely devastating impact on our ability as a local government to fund schools, to decide what funding, goes to which programs. You talk about, anything from school funding to criminal justice reform to how we operate, recycling programs or, how your trash gets picked up. All of that can have a negative, there can be negative impacts coming from the state. And so it's incredibly important, not just bench building, but to have people in local office who understand and who are willing to take those stands and be supportive. And it's hard, but it's so worth it. It's so worth it for our communities.
So people are motivated sometimes by those general issues and then other times by something extremely specific. And of course, I'm talking about the Dobbs decision this time around. Wow. And the amount of newly registered women versus men in many states, Wisconsin included, is that gap is widening more all the time. The question I continue to ask, and I will in the minute that we have left here, is How's your level of cynicism these days? Do you think this is all going to peter up by November, or do you think this is only going to build and have a major impact come November?
This is only going to keep building. This is only going to keep building. The longer this goes on, the women are in this, and folks are, and allies and folks identified, like we're in this for the long haul, and November's our shot. This is going to keep building. This is not going to peter out. This is too important.
Annalise, I've got a really good friend that I want to bring on as a guest of the show who works in the healthcare field. He says he'll only come on if he can spend the time debating Yacht Rock. And so I'm putting together a Yacht Rock special. I want to know if you will be on that panel at some point.
Absolutely.
Okay. This is all... you know, this is going to reduce Luke to a puddle, but I feel like it's a special show we have to do. Thanks for your time. Great to see you.
It was great seeing you, Pat and Luke.
Have a wonderful day. We'll wrap up the hour after this. You're up north. Welcome back. It's Monday morning, September 12th. Hope you had a good weekend. I'm Pat Kreitlow, along with Luke Mathers, spinning Yacht Rock for us again on a Monday morning. I did not see this live, but I see that there has been a lot of reaction to a recent appearance by former Minnesota Senator Al Franken on CNN, and it was a moment that the network needed because of its whatever the heck it's doing lately with new management that appears to be, it says they're just trying to be more both sides-ish. And of course, you know how I feel about that, that there it's a shift in editorial direction to neutrality, which is artificial and frankly gives way too much time to not just to a talking point, but to outright falsehoods, which are what, you know, far too many right-wing talking points are based on these days. And A, that's unfortunate, and B, that's true. It's that's not just, you know, a progressive talking point. It's rooted right there in fact. It's rooted in history. And that's what Al Franken points out when he was on with CNN's Jim Acosta and with a Republican strategist by the name of April Stewart. And there was this discussion about the U.S. Supreme Court and whether it's fair to call it an activist court now, as Vice President Kamala Harris did recently, because of some recent decisions. And Al Franken made the point that it is and explained why. April Stewart said, no, it's not, and gave a reason. And usually a CNN person would just let it go. But thankfully, Al Franken did not. Let's listen to that exchange.
The legitimacy of the court was undermined when they wouldn't take up Merrick Garland. And you'll remember that McConnell said it was because it was during election year. And you remember Lindsey Graham pledging that if a vacancy came open during election year in 20, that he wouldn't vote for it. They wouldn't take up a nominee. They've stolen two seats. The one that Merrick Garland wasn't given a hearing for, and the one that Coney Barrett was, where she was seated a week before the election. That destroyed the legitimacy of the court.
Alice, what do you think? Did Chief Justice Roberts sort of, I mean, he sort of ignored some of what Al is talking about there, and that there is a tremendous amount of controversy as to how this court got tilted in the direction of the far right.
Just to throw a little accuracy in some of what Al said there. Look, the Merrick Garland was held up because we had a divided government. We had a Democrat in the White House, and we had Republicans in control of.
That's not what McConnell said.
But that's the way historically this has been when you're in close to an election year and you have divided government.
That's not the way it's been historically done.
Yes. And when you have divided government, there typically is an inclination to.
Tell me when this happened before.
Well, Merrick Garland is certainly one. When there's a divided government.
No, before Merrick Garland.
They're not moving forward.
Tell me when this happened before.
Al, I'm telling you, this is what the Mitch
tell
McConnell
me when it
said.
Happened before.
I can't.
You said this
give
is
you
what happened historically. Tell me when it happened before.
Look, this is the way that the Republicans
went.
Like, I can't give you an exact example of when this happened in the past.
No, you know
but
why
can
you can't?
Tell you,
because you can't.
Because it's never happened before.
Because you can't. And that's why poor Alice Stewart, who I mistakenly called April, why poor Alice Stewart was left stammering there, because you had Franken first lay out the facts. Those were the exact facts of what happened with those two Supreme Court vacancies. And that when Stewart tried to basically make up history, Franken did what a reporter should have done. And I will say that much. Part of the reason people don't like to watch cable news, period, is because it's a lot of this back and forth that, you know, some viewers find distasteful. But the fact of the matter is it needed to be said in this instance. And I would have preferred if it was either Jim Acosta or any other journalist should have said, you know, basically stepped in and said, you know, Senator Franken, hang on a second. I'll take it from here. And kept asking the same question. When has this ever happened before? Because it hasn't.
Well, the interesting dynamic is in this clip, Al Franken is remote. He's joining them via Zoom or some kind of video telecommunication platform. And Jim Acosta and Alice are in the studio together. And Jim kind of just lets this happen.
Al do it. Like, hey, you hold her accountable. Yeah.
How do you think Alice felt after that segment was over? It was kind of in studio with Jim Acosta.
Well, look, here's what it does is it gives them another reason to call CNN fake news.
But had Jim stepped in and asked the follow up instead of former Senator Franken, they could have done the same thing. So they're going to do that.
No, they would have anyway.
Right. They're going to do that regardless. Yeah.
No, any time that a Republican is, you know, exposed, that is then turned around by them and said, oh, well, that just proves how, you know, they're against us. It's always an us against them thing. And I'm going to talk about that in the next hour that, you know, America has a very long history of an unfortunate or ugly or sometimes violent segment of the population that feeds off of an us versus them mentality. And you saw a little of it at this dinner I was trying to tell people about earlier in the hour before our technical glitches in Appleton, where journalist Lauren Windsor was there recording what Michael Gableman was saying, that Gableman again said that Mark Zuckerberg stole the election. And as we just mentioned, the Federal Elections Commission voted unanimously, Republicans and Democrats, to dismiss the complaint. There's no story there about what Zuckerberg's money to the CTCL did in these grants that were given to hundreds of communities across Wisconsin. So what Gableman is saying is a lie. Not wrong, it's a lie. And he knows that. And yet there he was saying, not willing to answer the journalist question that was there about why he didn't produce the documents that would claim the thing that he keeps claiming at the podium. And, you know, then Tim Michaels came up to that podium Friday night. It was a fundraiser for him. And he decried what he called the banana republics. And he means Wisconsin and other places that are resisting the efforts of Michaels and Trump and other election deniers to continue making trouble. And then Michaels again promised to transform education in the state through universal school choice. In other words, he doubled down on his attack on public schools and that he wants to dismantle public education. So Lauren Windsor's story continued and concluded saying, I left after Michaels, but they blocked me from talking to him. I went outside. A couple of attendees yelled at me and asked why I came to stir up trouble. I replied, I didn't. They're the ones that called me out and invited me on stage. And then she said, the fellow yelling at me calmed down and we had a lovely debate where we actually found common ground about big corporate government corruption and that we will have drinks together if he's ever in D.C. So again, you just got to have the conversations. More in our next hour. You're up north.